Blog Talk Radio.
Hold it now! Production presented Black Earth America, and this is the second Tuesday of the month. This we have healthy relationships. We're going to be talking about healthy relationships, and since this is the month, mental health month, you know, so I guess Ms. Dillard is going to be covering that. But before I bring you on, Ms. Dillard, I just want to tell you that We Talk Productions is one of the fewest Black-owned internet radio station that discusses solutions for Black folks. Now, I'm going to bring you on, Ms. Dillard, and you will not hear from me, and she has some guests on, and I'll let her explain. Hello, Ms. Ann. How you doing?
Hello, 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 Mr. Kitty Jones. It's good to be here with you tonight.
Yeah, happy belated Mother's Day.
Thank you. Thank you.
You
it was
your
a
guest.
Beautiful day. Yes, yes. So tonight I have two amazing colleagues with us to talk about mental health in the Black community as we recognize Mental Health Awareness Month. And so thank you again.
And I'm going back into the queue, and you will be running the show.
All right, now, feel free to come in and pop in and talk.
Nah, I'm going to leave it up to you, Ms. Ann.
Okay. All right. So I'll go ahead and...
2439, you're here. Hello?
Okay.
Hello?
Yes.
Hi, welcome to We Talk Radio, and I believe that this is this my guest Gina?
Yes, it is.
All right.
Okay.
So this
okay,
is
now let me
my
cue
colleague.
In the other one. Let me cue in the other
okay.
one.
Okay.
Hello.
All right.
Hello.
One. Okay.
All right. Welcome, and this is our other guest, Dr. Carlos Sapp, who's here with us tonight. So I'm excited to have my esteemed colleagues with us to discuss mental health in the Black community. So if we'll start with Gina. Gina, would you go ahead and tell the people who are listening who you are and how you serve in the world?
Yes, absolutely. Good evening, everyone. And thank you, Anne, for inviting me on this platform. I really appreciate it, and I'm excited to be here. My name is Gina Golden. I'm in Atlanta, Georgia. I have a private practice in the, you know, Buckhead area, Brookhaven area. I work with individuals primarily who, you know, individuals that are struggling with different things such as social anxieties, generalized anxiety disorders, depression, relationship difficulties, communication difficulties, self-esteem challenges. Most of the clients that come to see me, they come because they've tried different modalities or different techniques that haven't been very effective for them, because most of the people that are attracted to my practice love to incorporate holistic mind, body, and spirit techniques and approaches. And so that's who I serve. I serve primarily adults, mostly women of color or African-American women. And we offer in-office or face-to-face sessions as well as telemental health, which is a platform in which we are able to see and hear one another over the computer. So we do that as well. And yeah, that's how I serve people. I also do some speaking engagements and some training engagements as well. So that's how I serve my community.
Yes, thank you so much. Thank you, Ms. Gina, for being here. And I know that you can't stay with us the whole time, but I'm going to let Dr. Sapp introduce herself, and then we'll continue this conversation. Dr. Sapp, tell the people who you are.
Okay, thanks, Anne. Hello, everybody. First, I want to say again, thank you to Anne for having me on to discuss a much-needed topic. Hello to Gina, who's out there doing her thing in the Atlanta, Georgia area, someone who I follow on social media. I am Dr. Carla Sapp. I am from the Midway, Georgia area, kind of close to Savannah, near Fort Stewart, Georgia. Where I provide mental health services in the community. I have my own private practice where I typically work with student athletes. However, I also, on a need basis, take other clients as well, individuals, families, young, old. I also teach at a local college here, Georgia Southern University, at the Liberty Campus in the psychology department. And I work full-time for the federal prison system as a drug treatment specialist, working with adult male offenders. I think that's about it, Anne. Just kind of a snippet.
Well, you know, you also serve in the legislature, and I think that's a really important part of what you do, right?
I do. In the federal system, in the federal prison system, I do some legislative work with the Council of Prisons locals as well. So I find myself going up to D.C. a lot and doing some work, not just on Capitol Hill, but here within my community with local legislators just as well.
Awesome. And as you listeners can tell, we have a power-packed panel here tonight to talk about mental health challenges in the Black community. And for the longest, you know, talking about mental health issues in the Black community comes with such a stigma. And I'm so glad to see that the tides are changing a little bit. And we're making some progress and some headways in this. And I love the work that each of my colleagues are doing. And so we're going to be talking to you tonight about what does that look like and some solutions. And so if you are listening, feel free to call in with your questions to ask the experts who are here tonight to discuss this topic. Make sure you tell your friends that we are on, because we're going to have a very engaging conversation about mental health issues in the Black community. So I'm going to start by saying, you know, a lot of times in the Black community, when we talk about mental health issues, we associate words like crazy and other derogatory words with dealing with mental health issues. And I think that we have to look at it from different lens, because as much as we take care of our physical health, we go to the gym and we work out, or we walk, we join walking clubs or running clubs. We go to the doctor for our yearly physical, our annual mammogram and pap smear and things like that. I think it behooves us to also go for our mental health checkup, because that is a part that we often neglect. And Gina, I want you to talk about, what are you seeing with our Black women as you serve them? What are you seeing along the mental health spectrum?
Oh, okay. Well, first, let me say greetings to Dr. Carla Stapp. So, I do follow you, too. You're awesome, awesome, impactful therapist out there doing great work. So I do want to say hello to you and greetings. So what I'm seeing in the Black community among Black women is just a struggle, a challenge, working through a wide variety of issues, whether it's effective communication. I find that that is a huge challenge. Many people just haven't been taught how to communicate, or they go to a place that's unproductive. Not all of them, but, you know, some of them. The ones that come to a therapist is usually because there is some, you know, some dysfunction in some area, or some area that needs some improvement. And so maybe it's some communication problems at work, or in their relationship, or in parenting, and it causes a problem, you know, to grow. Oftentimes it starts off as a smaller problem, but because there's a lack of communication skills, it creates a larger problem, and it becomes, you know, pervasive throughout their interactions with others. And, you know, oftentimes people lose jobs because of it, right? They may go from literally zero to 100 and haven't figured out how to navigate their emotions as they're trying to communicate in a work environment. And oftentimes everything becomes...
I'm glad you said that.
Yes.
I'm glad you said that, Gina, because, you know, if I didn't know better, I would be sitting there saying, hey, how does communication, lack of communication, isn't a mental health issue. But I'm so glad that you're making the connection of how it ties in to other things that lead to mental health challenges.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, sometimes it's because of a lack of balance, a lack of homeostasis in their entire, you know, holistic selves, whether it's the mind, the body, the spirit. If there's an unbalance or dis-ease going on, oftentimes it plays itself out through communication, maladaptive behaviors, and so forth. So all of our behaviors are part of our communication. And so if someone is behaving in a certain way, that in essence is a communication challenge as well. There's also another challenge I see a lot of, is just basic self-esteem that hasn't been fully developed, recognized, acknowledged. And so that comes off as, you know, it plays itself out in a variety of ways as well. A lot of our families, you know, that we're raised in, there was a lot of emotional dysregulation in the families. Maybe one or both parents may have had a mental health challenge. And so there, you know, that kind of created a space in the home that wasn't healthy, right? And maybe the child didn't develop emotional regulation. Obviously, they could actually have their own, you know, mental health disorders as Black women, you know, just like any other group of people. They have, you know, mental health disorders just like anyone else, like any other group. And sometimes it's as a result of, you know, domestic violence or neglect, severe neglect or severe abuse or sexual assault. I mean, it can have its origins in so many things, and some of it is hereditary, you know, and it just can go on and on.
Well, Gina, I know that you're not going to be able to stay with us throughout the whole show. So if you have questions for Gina Golden, please call in or, you know, to share your questions with us. When a lot of times when we think about mental health issues in the Black community, we're like, we're not going to take any medicine. We're not going to do that. And that's one of the reasons why I'm so glad that Gina is one of our panelists tonight, because she introduces different holistic methods of healing to our community. And I think that it's very important that we look at the different options that are available to us. So, I know Dr. Sapp is there, and we're going to have her talk, but since you have to go, I want you to share with our audience some of the alternative healing methods that you share with our community.
Right, right. So I find that that is a huge concern in the Black community, especially among African-American women, when it comes to medication, you know, in terms of managing symptoms of anxiety or depression or personality disorder or bipolar or some sort of mood disorder, if it's presented to them, if medication is presented as an option, there is usually a lot of pushback around that. And I understand that. You know, one, we have a long history regarding African Americans and the medical establishment in terms of medication and treatment. So just historically, there's been this distrust among the health industry in terms of all the, you know, the violence and the trauma that has been imposed on our people because of treatments and mistreatments and, you know, all kinds
and
of studies that were done
right?
on experiments and studies and a lack of consent and all of that. And so, you know, I think a lot of that has been passed down from generation to generation. I don't think anyone sits down and tell their daughter, oh, don't trust them. But, you know, it's a learned behavior. They watch the family and watch how they, you know, interface with the doctor or the psychiatrist, and they learn through, you know, that interchange that, okay, this is not something I want to do. I don't trust them. They don't have my best interest at heart. And so that's why it's important that African-American people are in this field, in the mental health field, to help bridge that gap, you know, in our community, so they could see a familiar face, see someone from their community that go to, you know, maybe have the same faith or the same religion or the same spiritual underpinnings that they can go to and feel a sense of community and connection.
Yeah.
And so because of that, when they come to me, most of the people that are coming to me or my practice is because, you know, someone has suggested medication and they just don't feel comfortable. So they're really desperate to find another method that they can use to help them with their, you know, their condition or their challenge. And so I offer a couple of alternative practices that doesn't require medication, although it doesn't mean that I am against them getting medication. In fact, if I see that a client can benefit greatly from that, of course, I recommend it, and we talk about the pros and the cons, and we just, you know, go through the whole thing, and I will give them a referral to a psychiatrist for a medication evaluation. But for those that are absolutely opposed that or have tried that to no avail, I may offer them hypnotherapy. So I am a certified hypnotherapist and have trained extensively to provide that modality to people who want to really tap into their own inner inner wisdom and their own inner power to help them understand themselves better and take more control of their mind, body, and spirit and tap into their inner resources. So I do offer that. So many people come to me because they've either tried other things or the other things they're afraid of, or they're just not, you know, down or with those other options. And so I also use something called emotional freedom technique, which is a tapping is another name that it goes by. Emotional freedom technique is all about using your own hands to tap into the energy meridians that are in and throughout your body. And the belief is that if you can tap on certain meridians in your body or on your body, that helps to release the blockages, the energy blockages that hold pain, emotional pain and physical pain. And so I teach them how to do that in session for relief. You know, it was born out of an Eastern medicine technique like acupressure and acupuncture. But it's not the exact same, but it's, you know, it comes from that that legacy.
Wow.
And of course, other things like mindfulness and aromatherapy and healing crystals and things like that. So I incorporate a holistic approach with my clients, and, you know, they enjoy it, they like it, they benefit from it. And of course, again, if we find that they need to see a medical doctor or a psychiatrist, then definitely I do refer on to that as well. And then I work in conjunction with a psychiatrist if need be.
Wow. So you offer a wide array of treatment modalities, which is very, very important, very significant. Again, I encourage you to take care of your mental health, and there are a variety of ways in which you can do so. There is not just one clear-cut way. So thank you, Gina, for sharing that with us. Again, tell the audience how they can find you as you leave.
Okay. You can definitely find me by way of my website at www.innercoachhypnotherapy.com. That's www.innercoachhypnotherapy.com. Or you can email me at info@innercoachhypnotherapy.com. That's info@innercoachhypnotherapy.com. So those are probably the best ways to get in touch with me. My website, you can always leave me a message, and it'll get forwarded to my email, so I will get it. And I usually can respond within 24 to 48 hours. So please be patient that I will get back to you. But I can stay on the line for another 10 minutes or so, so I just want to let you know that as well, Anne.
Awesome. So if you're listening and you have questions for Ms. Gina Golden, feel free to call in. And Brother Kenny, if you would give them the number so that we can remind our audience how to call in, that would be great. I think I lost them. All right, so let's move it right along, and we're going to be talking to Dr. Carla Scott, and I just love her, love the work that she's doing and the lives that she is impacting. And Carla, one of the things that I really appreciate about what you do is you serve a specific population of society. You serve inmates. And we know that there is a large population of African Americans who are incarcerated. And I just wanted you to talk a little bit also about what are you seeing as it relates to mental health in our prisons?
Yes, I do work with the inmate population and have worked with the inmate population for quite some time, stemming all the way back to working with adolescent juvenile delinquents, doing juvenile probation, and also working with mandated offenders who were doing court-ordered drug treatment through Recovery Place here in the Savannah, Georgia, and also in the Hinesville, Georgia area. So I've had a lot of experience. And then going into the prison system and been in there for the past 8 years, it kind of just has all come together. And you see a lot.
Yes.
A lot of times when people think about mental health and mental illnesses, they think severe. They think kind of what you said earlier with the stigma. They start to attach those stigmas. Oh, they're just crazy. They have all these names for them. And yet what they fail to realize is that a larger part of that society are coming from broken homes, and they're coming from a history of trauma and abuse. And so you see that a lot, and you start to see those behavioral patterns that they've used, which were maladaptive, as their coping skills. That's what they've continued to do into their adulthood. And so those behaviors start to play out in their relationships with significant others, family members, children. And they find themselves into this offender lifestyle as a way of kind of dealing with some of the issues that they're having. They're not used to consequences, and or for some of them it's that cry for help. And so you see a lot of that, where a lot of them just have a lot of things that stem from their childhood, those adverse childhood experiences, parents being incarcerated, being raised by grandparents. You also see a lot of times growing up and living in certain environments where they didn't have the best schools. They're used to violence happening, the police constantly being in their environment. And all those things are just as significant and very traumatic as is being physically abused or sexually abused. And so we tend to not focus on that much, that piece a lot, because we think, oh,
yeah,
it doesn't really affect them, but it does neurologically. It ultimately alters their brain. And if their brain is starting to alter, then, you know, motivation and drive and their ability to reason tends to start to decrease as a result of the things that they're experiencing impacting them neurologically, just as well as psychologically and even physiologically. And so with all three of those pieces kind of together, you find them in this place of desperation.
Right.
They don't know how to cope.
So when we talk about maladaptive coping skills, can you break that down a little bit for our lay listeners?
Okay, good. So maladaptive coping skills: smoking, drinking, engaging in criminal activities, anger, domestic violence, as Gina was talking about briefly a few minutes ago. All of those things are ways that they cope: being very isolative, not talking to people, having this need to be in control, being very manipulative at points in time. All of those are ways that people typically, and what I've actually seen with a lot of not just the offenders that I work with now, but offenders that I've worked with in the past, that's how they cope. And so a lot of times you hear people when they talk about addiction, well, I wish they would just stop. Why can't they just stop? As easy as it is for them to pick it up and start using, it should be just as easy to put down. It doesn't happen that particular way. They're using it as a method to escape their reality, and that's their way of being able to cope. As maladaptive as it sounds to them, if I don't have to deal with all the things that are happening in my life presently, all the things that have happened in my life in the past that have shaped me into this person that I am, if that's how I can cope and that's how I can continue to move forward every day and not have to think about it, then that's what I will do. And so that's where a lot of times you see that substance abuse piece come in, with the use of marijuana, goes into, you know, using even harder illicit drugs, cocaine, crack, heroin, LSD. You start to find that experimentation going on a lot more. And then the more they use, the more their tolerance increases, the more dependent their body becomes on the substance because they're taking it in a lot more.
Right. And you know, we're talking about maladaptive coping methods and overeating, misuse of food, misuse of sex, misuse of gambling. Those are also components of maladaptive behaviors. And when we're talking
about all of those are addiction. A lot of times people don't think about that. They only think about the drugs and the alcohol, but the gambling, the sex, the food, the excessive working out, all of those are addictions, because addictions are things that you kind of become more obsessive and more compulsive about. It starts to impact your ability to function in a healthy manner. So if I'm constantly, you know, if I'm overeating, I'm overly consuming, or I'm being very promiscuous, and or if I'm spending money that I should be spending on my bills,
yes,
gambling. Those things are addictions.
Yes, that is so true. And then when, you know, I know you and I also work with the younger population, and we'll see things like acting out risky behaviors. We'll see cutting and self-harm,
yes,
behaviors, because these things start at an early age, and it's usually the inability or the lack of skills to cope with stressors.
With non-injurious behaviors, typically when we think about our cutters and we think about those who are doing some type of self-harm, more times than not, they're not as suicidal. It's more passive than it is being that they are fully actively suicidal, having the ideation and the intent. Now, granted, most things happen at points and times, and they get to that place. But a lot of our cutters and a lot of our non-injurious behaviors, and especially in adolescence, it's acting out. It's that cry for help. I'm seeking attention. And so, you know, teachers and other adults, we see it as you're misbehaving. You know better than to act like that. Stop it. A lot of times they're wanting somebody to pay them some attention. They're hoping that that one person will be able to say, okay, come here, what's going on? Talk to me.
Right.
Why do you
right.
acting like that? Can you explain to me why? What makes you act like this? Being able to engage them in dialogue is so very important, because these are kids who are coming from homes that are dysfunctional. These are kids who are coming from homes where there's only one parent, and or not even a parent. They're being raised by their grandparents. They're living in environments that are unhealthy. They've been abused. They've seen substance abuse happening. They've seen violence happening. And so they're experiencing a lot, especially kids today, versus kids,
yes,
from later years. Our kids today are experiencing a lot. They're seeing things,
yes,
not just in their homes, they're seeing things on TV. They're hearing things on the radio. They're seeing things happening in the school system. And so it's so important to pay attention to the behaviors, because while to adults those behaviors are very kind of defiant and, you know, you need to stop
uh-huh.
it, those are some early signs of saying, okay, I need to pay more attention. I need to talk to this child, and I need to seek, you know, help this child and the parents seek some help, being able to connect them with the resources within the community, with mental health therapists and social workers, to be able to have that safe place where they can begin to work on the issues that they're experiencing, with the hopes of being able to thrive and becoming more productive and having coping skills that are very healthy, and not continuing on the cycle and in the behaviors that they're presenting.
Yes, and I think that's so true. And I just want to back up a little bit. And when we talk about trauma, a lot of people might say trauma this, trauma that, you know, I'm sick of hearing about trauma. But I think that it's important that our audience understand trauma as, you know, this is the definition that I absolutely love, is something that happens too much, too fast, too soon.
Mm-hmm.
And you're not equipped to deal with it.
Deal
it could
with
be
it.
A car accident, right? It could be a fire.
Right.
It could be witnessing domestic abuse. It could be
right.
being bullied. You
mm-hmm.
know, anything that happens too much, too fast, too soon is considered trauma.
Exactly. Something that's disturbing. Even the loss of a loved one, an unexpected loss of a loved one. You think kids, and especially now, you know, a lot of kids, their grandparents are realizing, hey, grandparents are getting older, and grandparents don't live forever. And not just grandparents, because you kind of almost expect that, but they're losing classmates. And,
yes,
and when you're
yes.
losing when you're losing classmates who
yeah.
are your age, and when you're young and you have this notion of, you know, we live forever, we're invincible, and then a classmate gets into a car accident and,
mm-hmm.
you know, with their parents, and now that classmate's gone, that's traumatic. So it's,
yes.
it's all those different
and
pieces. It's distressing and it's disturbing.
And
yeah,
generational.
Right.
It's generational trauma. And so we know now that traumatic experiences are passed down three generations
mm-hmm.
through our DNA. And so even if you
yes.
yourself didn't experience the trauma directly, the
mm-hmm.
fact that your grandmother did can shift how you show up in the world. Epigenetics. And so we need to start looking at epigenetics and how that mm-hmm. impacts people and our, you know, our community and our families. And we can't always just see this child in school saying, oh, she had everything, or she's, you know, she has an intact family, or everything is going well with her. Why is she behaving this way? So sometimes mm-hmm. things are mm-hmm. passed down and her genetic code is shifted because of what happened to her family member. And now we have mm-hmm. to be serious about looking in the future as the next generations after us. Now, imagine just mm-hmm. a few years ago on to now, up to now, there has been an onslaught of murders and police brutality on a people, our people, right? So that mm-hmm. is being plastered all over the television, all over the internet. People personally know people, and that has to impact future generations. Even if it stopped today, the fact that we and our children's children are experiencing yes. this now, not only is it bringing down their self-worth and how do they define who they are in this world if they're getting messages that just walking while black, talking while black, sitting while black, you know, reading while black,
driving while black.
Yes.
You know, anything by while black can cause you to be thrown in jail or murdered. How does that impact not only this generation but the three generations down the line that epigenetics mm-hmm. is showing that gets attached to our DNA? So absolutely mental
and
health
I think
is important.
Yeah.
And I like that you brought that up, Gina, because
yes.
I've explained epigenetics to individuals, and they're like, I don't get that. And so I tell them, if your grandmother, when your grandmother was carrying your mother essentially was carrying you. And so that's that three generation right there. And so whatever grandma's experience and mama's experience, because grandma and mama's experiencing it, then I'm experiencing it too. And that's so important to understand just how close we are and how linked we are and how what one person experiences ultimately impacts generations. It's kind of that ripple effect. One person mm-hmm. experiences it, and it goes to the next person and then the next person, because until we get to a place where we can start addressing it and being able to work through that, it's going to continue.
And I think you ladies brought up something really key because, you know, in the Jewish community, we look at studies that show secondary post-traumatic stress disorder from studies of children of survivors of the Holocaust and how it's impacted them.
Mm-hmm.
And in some arenas, that's more acceptable than the idea of epigenetics happening in the black community, because I'll hear people
Absolutely.
Say, well, I, you know, slavery, it's been so many years, get over it. When are you all going to move beyond that? But they're less tolerant and less accepting of that in the black community than they are when it's brought forth as PTSD of the survivors, of the children of survivors of the Holocaust.
Absolutely. I went to a training once before and someone brought that up. And we spent quite a bit of time talking about the Holocaust and its impact on the Holocaust survivors and the generations that came after, and how that shifted the DNA and shifted even the cortisol levels and adrenaline and the norepinephrine in their bodies to like kind of keep them on high alert based off of a system that happened to their great grandparents that they didn't themselves experience. And then when it got down to talking about African Americans, we spent maybe 2 minutes talking about it. And I was just in a daze because I said, you know, I was in a group of people and they just they could see how the Holocaust made sense, but they couldn't see how systemic racism and
mm-hmm.
multi-generational trauma can impact us. It's as if our skin is thicker than theirs. Our blood is thicker than theirs. We can just cope with trauma after trauma after trauma, and it just doesn't impact us in the same way. And so that's why it's helpful. I mean, it's crucial that we have clinicians of color to make those connections for our clients or help to connect those dots, because they just think that they're operating, you know, in a vacuum, that they're alone, it's just me. And when they can, when we can connect with them person to person and say, I get you, like, I understand why you're so angry. I understand why you turn to drugs because of your coping mechanism. I understand why you, you know, fight immediately. I understand why you need to, you know, self-soothe through all these maladaptive behaviors. I get you, you know, and that is a deeper, because as African people, connection and relationship is everything. It's everything.
Everything.
And so we have to connect on a different level than any other group of clinicians, I believe.
And that, yeah. in the other piece to connection and relationship, I would add, is shared stories.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I think our stories are, you know, having somebody hear your story and can identify with your story and help you to walk through that, I think that is such a powerful piece of our DNA.
Mm-hmm. I would definitely agree with that, given a lot of times you have a lot of individuals who feel alone and they don't feel that others are going through what they are going through. And so that's where that isolation piece comes in. And so being able to help them feel comfortable and help them see that they're not the only person, that other people are experiencing these things, and being able to use their experiences and how they were able to overcome the experiences that they may have been experiencing by using coping skills that were healthy and being able to move forward and be productive gives them a sense of hope. And so I fall back on that whole piece of, we have to, as clinicians, and not just even as clinicians, just as a culture and as a race, we have to be able to empower and instill hope within our communities, because that's so important.
That is so important. You hit the nail on the head. It is important because sometimes, like you said, I mean, we may be the only people that will offer hope. You know, in a place where maybe the educational system seems like it's against you, or the financial institutions, or the all kinds of institutions, like whatever institution you can name, if they all seem to be bearing down on you, even the system of the family, you know, whatever it is, your religious system, if they all seem to not be for you, then you need somebody to say there's hope, and I'm here with you. I'm taking this journey with you. We are together in this process, and we have to join them, and you know, they have to just, you know, trust us, and we have to obviously build that trust and that sense of community and connectedness.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think you all, I mean, when I think of hope, it brings me also to the religious institutions within our community. And I will say that I believe that things are getting so much better with the acceptance of mental health care in the religious community. And I think that's still one of the most impactful community in the African, agency in the African American community. So would you all just take a couple minutes to talk about what are some of the things, the changes that you see, the shift that's happening in our religious institutions in the Black community, and what else can we do to move things along?
I think for me, I think being able to separate, one of the biggest things that I've seen is that being able to separate religion from spirituality And being able to understand that while religion is more of my belief, that spirituality piece is my meaning and my purpose, and starting to see that piece become a lot more intertwined in the churches, and being able to also see that more and more people are understanding that what used to be the church was our safe place. That was the place we could go and be able to feel safe and feel like we were amongst others who felt the same way that we felt, who were experiencing those same things. And so using that safe place now in order to be able to bring in this aspect of mental health and being able to talk about it, knowing that in me being well spiritually, I will be well mentally and emotionally, and mm-hmm. understanding that we're experiencing things on a different level now. I know last week you and I talked, and that was yes. one of the things that I brought up, was just that whole aspect of, you know, we're whole beings, and in us being whole beings, there are many yes. facets that comes with us, you know, our mental, our physical, our occupational, our spiritual, even down to our leisure activities, our economics, and our finances. So all those pieces play a part in who I am. And if I'm not well spiritually, those other areas tend to find themselves. You think about a car, and, you know, when you need a front-end alignment on your car, everything else starts to fall apart. And that's how we are as individuals. If when one area of my life isn't good, one area of my life is struggling, I'm going to start struggling in those others. And one of the things that I say a lot of times is, you know, the whole faith without works is dead. And so I can have faith all day long that things are going to get better, but I got to put in the work. And where does that work come from? That work comes from going and being able to allow myself to be vulnerable and going and seeking the help that I need in order for me to become whole again and for me to feel good.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's good.
I think we're at a great time in mental health history. You know, I think we're at a really good mm-hmm. space where people – are recognizing that you can have both. You know, there's
yes.
so many slogans and so many movements now that wasn't around 20 years ago, where people were saying, oh, you can have, you know, you can go to God, or you can go to church and to a therapist, or you can explore your spirituality and see a mental health professional. Before, it was so separate, you know, there was no blending of the two. There was no understanding that there should never have been a separation. That, like you said, it's a holistic. We are whole, right? And spirituality mm-hmm. is part of that. And like you said, Carla, it's just, you know, understanding that religion and spirituality is very different. And so when the therapist understands that, they get to help the client explore on a higher level, and instead of keeping everything in a box, like, oh, okay, we're going to only talk about Islam, or we're going to only talk about Christianity, or, you know, that to me puts things in a box, where spirituality opens it up to mean so many higher level things, or higher order kind of things, I see. And I remember going through my own training, you know, because my program had an Afrocentric approach, they understood spirituality. And that was back in the mm-hmm. early 90s. You know, they understood the importance of spirituality, especially with people of color, because of our long history with religion and spirituality. So we were trained to do that. But then, after I got my master's degree, then, you know, once you start working for agencies, they would say, no, you know, let's make this cut off. We do not talk about this. We do not talk about that. And I get that. I understand that. But I think that all the stars and the moon and the galaxy is all in alignment right now, where it's just a good time. People are understanding what it means to explore that part of us openly and freely, without hiding, without dogma, without, you know, all these other things that come with it. You know, when clients come to see me and they know I'm a hypnotherapist, part of what I ask them is, do you have a higher power, or what do you, you know, what do you recognize as a higher power? Most of them answer that. I mean, every now and again, I'll get an atheist, which is fine, but for the most
part, you have a caller. You want to accept the call?
Awesome. All right, go ahead and finish. Okay, go ahead and finish your thought, and we're going to get our caller.
Okay, I'll put her back in queue. Okay.
Okay.
So they'll let me know, well, I see the universe as my, you know, my power or my higher power, or I see God as my higher power, or Jesus, or the trees, or love, or whatever, Mother Earth, Divine Spirit, whatever they say, I go with that, you know, and I let them explore that freely and openly and honestly, because that's who they are. That's who, how they show up, and I meet them where they are. I don't try to get them to understand my understanding or my way of life. In fact, my clients don't even have a clue what my spirituality is, because I'm so open, and I let people know I accept all spiritual beliefs, even including people who don't have one, or so they say, you know, like they haven't identified something. So I think that's pivotal, because, you know, if the scales are unbalanced, even on the spiritual realm, that impacts the emotional and the mental realm. And so people need to feel balanced in all areas of their lives. So, yeah.
Wow. I think that's powerful. Yes, Brother Kenny, if you would put our caller through. All right. Welcome to our caller. Do you have a question or a comment for us tonight? Hello? All right. Is our caller still there? Do you have a question or a comment for us?
Oh, hello? Can you guys hear me?
Yes. Yes, we can. Welcome. Thank you for calling in.
Oh, yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Go ahead. Introduce yourself and tell us if you have a question or a comment.
My name is Equanib. I'm calling from South Carolina. And I just wanted to kind of comment, piggyback behind what the sister was saying. I guess as it relates to things that she and others like her, you guys, you know, helping and being counselors and therapists, so to speak, to our people. It is a very important and imperative thing to understand. I'm going to say the disconnect, or where the disconnect lies. And being that we have a group of our people that are at different places where, you know, I'm not going to say all Jesus, but some people may believe in the tooth fairy, saying, well, hey, well, the tooth fairy is going to come and fix our problems or our issues. But when you look scientifically, of course, there is a disconnect, because when it comes down to putting food on your table, paying your light bill, or paying, you know, paying your rent, there's a method to the madness. So you actually have to go out and get a job. You know, praying might help or assist on some things, but praying alone won't keep your lights on, nor will it, you know, keep you out of harm's way if harm actually comes to you, when we're looking at science. And so it's definitely very important that we stay meditative, that we are, you know, definitely communicating with ourselves spiritually, and also detaching ourselves away from, I'm going to say, this, the unconscious mind that we have a lot of times. We just give it all up to Jesus and let Jesus fix it type of deal. And therefore, we see where we are current day. Us, out of all people, all ethnic groups, we probably do it more so than anybody else, but we celebrate Allah, we celebrate Jesus, God, we celebrate Yahweh. We even got black folks that are doing the Buddha thing, and But collectively, us as a black people, none of it is working for us because we're still getting shot down in the street. I just saw a video of the pregnant young black lady that got killed by the police. These are the situations our children, regardless if they are atheists or if they are Christian, children collectively are having to see this type of thing. So when they look at that black lady getting killed, I don't think they care if she's a Muslim or a Christian. You know, she's black. And so I'm at a place where I am trying to figure out some of the things that are going to work for black folk rather than, you know, a lot of the feel-good programs. So I definitely want to just salute to you guys and the work that the sister is doing, especially in the community. Because one thing about this objective to put black people back together is going to kind of be like eating the elephant, and it's not one thing that you can eat in a day. Actually going to have to chop it down bit by bit, piece by piece, and stay consistent on the job and the duties of healing ourselves and our people. But, you know, this was a great show, great topic, and, you know, just from the part that I caught.
Uh-huh. Well, thank you for sharing, brother. And I think one of the amazing things about the society that we live in is that we can decide and choose to use what we believe is working for us. And you know, what might be working for some people might not be working for others. And I think having that option to choose is a great thing, and one of the great things that we must continue to celebrate. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, Gina and Dr. Carla, we are at the top of the hour, and I just want to give you just a minute each to just finalize your thoughts, and then we're going to wrap up the show for tonight. Start with Gina.
Okay, so I wanted to say, yeah, I actually stayed longer than I anticipated, but it was really exciting. My son is home from college, but he said he was good, so I stayed longer than planned. But responding to what the caller just said, you know, you're right. It's going to take an approach from all different angles, from all mm-hmm. different levels, you know, from the micro level where we're doing one-on-one counseling, to a meso level where we're doing maybe group and community work, to a macro level where we're doing legislative work. And so you're right. I mean, in order to quote-unquote fix our community, we have to take that approach. And we're not suggesting that one-to-one talk therapy is the answer, but it definitely helps to bring clarity and support and, like Dr. Sack said, hope. And without hope, we really can't do much else. If you don't see
right.
that things can shift and change, then you lose the ability to want to affect change. And so then you can kind of go down a dark rabbit hole of hopelessness and then helplessness. And so it's a collective responsibility from the community, from all facets of the community. And this is just what we offer. It doesn't say that we are one-dimensional. Many therapists are dynamic in terms of offering a wide variety of services and support, even volunteer work. So with the brother who called, we need you. With your insight and with your support, we need the entire community to help lift and continue to support the rest of the community. We can't do it alone. There is a lot of systemic racism and oppression, and it's going to take, the masses to change those systems, right? One person can't do it. A small group of people cannot do it. But a collective can. And so
awesome.
That's what I wanted to offer.
Awesome. All right, Dr. Carla, we got 1 minute, and the music is going to start playing.
Wait,
soon.
One
Go
second.
Ahead. Okay. Are you there?
I'm here.
Okay. Go ahead.
Okay. I just want to say that I think that Gina summed it up perfectly, because that's the whole time that's what I was thinking. It's going to take a collective effort. I think that this was a great discussion and a great way to start the discussions in our communities, because it takes more than one. It takes us all. We all have to be willing to come together to make that change, to see that change happen. And so I truly think Gina summed it up perfectly in what she said.
Awesome. Well, thank you all. And Brother Kenny, thank you again for having us on Relationship Second Tuesday. And take it away.